My pleasure to welcome everybody here to Kehilat Chovei Tzion for this very special program. I know on Thanksgiving it's a day that we're dedicated to towards our families, and we're away from work, most of us, and we don't really have the formal obligation to work. So it says a lot of the community and those of you who are here today that you made it here today to study and to learn in the spirit of healthy family dynamics. We're going to do full acknowledgments a little later, but I would just like to thank first and foremost the Legacy Heritage Fund and Yeshiva University and the Center for the Jewish Future for helping to put together today's program. We're very excited. We have three top-notch scholars, and if you've heard of any of them, or if you've heard any of them, I'm sure you can attest to the fact they are all outstanding. Dr. Norman Blumenthal, just a brief synopsis of his accomplishments. He's the director of Bereavement and Crisis Intervention Services for Chai Lifeline. He's the education director of the Bella and Harry Wexner Kol Elyon and Semicha Honors Program at the Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary Yeshiva University, and many, many more attributes and accolades that he possesses. Dr. John Krug is the dean of student life at the Frisch Yeshiva High School in Paramus, New Jersey. He has a Master of Arts in Psychology and a doctorate in Clinical Psychology from the Furkauf Graduate School, as well as a postdoctoral fellowship at the Bar-Ilan University in Israel, where he also served as an adjunct professor. He was ordained at Reitz, Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary, Yeshiva University, and an adjunct professor in both Reitz as well as the Azrieli Graduate School of Jewish Education. And soon enough, we're going to have Rabbi Kenneth Brander here, and we'll introduce him fully when he arrives. Just briefly, we have two concurrent panel discussions that are taking place. The first session, which takes place now for the next 50 minutes, 55 minutes or so, will be Dr. Blumenthal on the topic of you never stop being a parent relating to adult children. That will be in the room right next door. And Dr. John Krug, growing up healthy in an abnormal world. What I will ask is that everybody who comes to each session, try to move up to the front, or at least we have an aversion to standing in the front row, go to the second row and fill up like that. That way we can have the best possible group dynamic. Welcome, and I hope everybody enjoys, and we'll have further acknowledgments of all those who have helped out later on.
Boker mediocre, everybody, and happy Thanksgiving. I have a tendency to talk too quickly, but I only do that for the first part and tell a little bit about who I am, what I do, when I do it, how I do it, why I do it, where I do it. And then in under an hour, I am supposed to tell you or discuss with you or react to how to raise a healthy child or how to raise a normal child in an abnormal world. Right, we're supposed to do it in 55 minutes. Kids do not come with instructions. You buy a mattress, it comes with instructions. You have a kid, it doesn't come with instructions. It's wonderful. All right, my name is Johnny Krug. My students who I teach Chumash to call me Rabbi Krug. The students I teach AP Psych to call me Dr. Krug. Some kids call me things I can't say in public and feel that way as well. And there are basically four things I do in life. One is I'm the dean of the Frisch Yeshiva High School in Paramus, New Jersey, a co-ed school of 650 students from grades 9 through 12. That's primarily what most of my day is occupied with. I am also a professor in two of Yeshiva University's graduate schools, one of the School of Education and one of the School of the Rabbinics, the Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary. I also maintain a private practice, and I do an awful lot of theatrical work. I worked off-Broadway at a show called The Fantastics for 29 years as its assistant producer, and to this day I'm designing shows for Broadway and off-Broadway as a line designer and production consultant. I'm not saying that either to impress or depress you. I'm just letting you know. Oh, thank you. I'm just letting you know where I come from. I hope it's okay. See, nobody else is wearing a tie except for the rabbi. So I'm going to partially disrobe if I can do that. Aha. Okay. I hope you have these outlines. Oh, okay. Thank you. I hope you have these outlines. Could be a short quiz next period. No, I'm just... I figured you sell the way in the back. I can talk to you like my students. What I like to try and do is to spin some theories, and after I spin the theories, I always try and give you some practical examples, go along with those theories, and maybe from that we can hopefully understand something towards kids. I've tried to raise, along with my wife, five of our own, and ask you about 50 years if it's been successful or not. We're still working on it. The jury is out. Jewish education, having entered the 20th century, I brought along the latest audiovisual techniques with me. Of course, we're in the 21st century, but Jewish education is in the 20th century. I have the latest audiovisual techniques. And we're going to the first theory, for those of you who are following in the outlines here. We're going to talk about something that Gardner Murphy introduced a long time ago, and I kind of took to a slightly higher level. Here is mom and dad. Boom. Here is little baby. Baby. Mom and dad. Boom. All right. Audiovisual techniques. Birth. Okay, kid is born. All of a sudden, we have a little one lying around that wasn't there before. And now we are faced with a challenge. What happens with these little beings that are out there? Something very interesting, according to the theory of Gardner-Murphy, happens. Mom and dad, boom, little baby, bing, whoosh, real tight orbit around mom and dad. Real tight orbit. It's like a little satellite, hence the word satellization. The little being needs mom and dad for everything. The little being would not survive if it were not for mom and dad. It needs mom and dad to have his diapers changed, to be cuddled when it's feeling lonely, to be fed so it doesn't starve to death. Everything it needs mom and dad for. Therefore, mom and dad are at the center of the universe of little being. A real tight orbit. And you can see this at work. You can see what's called satellization at work. For example, a little kid will generally not walk more than about a half a block in front of mommy and daddy, check over his shoulder, and make sure mommy and daddy are still there. That's satellization. Satellization is a little kid falling down, skinning his or her knee, its knee, not his or her, is not one being, right? His knee, her knee. Okay, fall down, skin the knee, look up, find mommy, dash into her skirts, and then burst out crying hysterically. Satellization. Tied orbit. Mommy and daddy at the center of the universe of little being. And something strange begins to happen as little being begins to grow. Orbit begins to widen slightly. Yeah, mom and dad are still at the center of the universe of little being, but the orbit is a little bit wider right now. When does that happen? Thank you for bringing the little baby for as part of the audiovisual display. When does that happen? When does orbit begin to widen? When baby gets language acquisition. Important moment in life. Baby's been hanging around life, just looking around, absorbing tons of stuff, and these sounds that come out of this orifice in the middle of the face, these sounds seem to be pretty important to the size of the baby. And baby's going to begin developing language. One day, baby talks. Okay? Let me set the stage for you. Okay? Baby's sitting in the high chair. And mommy comes over and goes, "Hi, sweetie, eat your creamed asparagus." And the kid's going to talk for the first time. And it is going to use a word that it has heard most often, because this seems to be a pretty important word. And baby looks up and goes, "No." Dum, dum, dum. Confrontation. Psychologists like to talk about the terrible twos. I love to talk about the terrific twos. Because when a baby starts doing that, it means it's getting its tiny little eensy-weensy budding muscles of independence. It has some control over its own destiny. It has some input into its own being. It's developing some essence unto itself. And baby goes, "No." How does mother handle it at that point? "Ah!" Right? Or the famous one, "Just wait till your father gets home. Woo! We're going to make daddy the evil incarnate." Wonderful. Okay. I know how most daddies handle that. Most daddies come in and look at the kid and go, "Assert your creamed asparagus, pow," across the kisser. And the little kid starts, because it is less painful to eat the creamed asparagus than to go up against the big gargantuan daddy. That's not the most effective form of discipline for anybody who's interested in that. By the way, daddy who does that will use the same technique years later. That's the same daddy that will walk into his teenage daughter's room 15 years later and say, "I said get off the floor," and out come the wires from the wall. That's also not the most effective form of discipline, which we can get to later. Okay, little being starts to talk. We have a major problem with little beings who start to talk nowadays. I'm going to come back to that a little bit later on in the outline, because we are very negatively being impacted by the unraveling of the English language. Now, the British have accused us of that for years, but we have seen that happen, and I will get back to that in a second, which we call linguistic regression, which is number 3. I am still in satellization. Orbit begins to widen, and the orbit gets wider and wider. Kid goes off to school. Kid has contact with other adults. One of the things that I suggest to young marrieds, and not young marrieds don't always like to hear this because they find it threatening, that when your kids are young, it's a great time to have them develop relationships with other adults. Why? Because sure as shooting, that kid's going to reach an age where they're going to be teenagers, and you're going to say white, and they're going to say black, like that. Not because of what you're saying, but because of the role you're playing. And when your kids are young, it's a great time to get them to foster relationships with people that you can pick out at that age. Rhonda across the street, Uncle Al. Somebody that you know reflects your family philosophy, your hashkafa, your outlook on life. Because when you put that in place when a kid is 4, 5, 6, 7, and they become 14, 15, 16, and 17, and you know they're going to go running, talking to Rhonda, and Rhonda's going to say the exact same thing that you would have said. You see, they'll take it from her and not from you because of your role and their attempts to get independence. You've put the places, you've put the safety net in place already. Some practical technique. Some young marrieds don't like to do it because they feel threatened. Hey, I'm the parents. Yeah, there's going to come a time you will remain the parents, but there's going to be a piece in there which we will get to in just a few minutes in which you're going to get rejected and you should not take it personally. Because teenagers are very strange beings. Let me tell you a very quick story. I was sent to Bellevue, not as an inpatient, for those of you who know Bellevue. I was in my training as a clinical psychologist, and I'm going to be working at Bellevue. That's, for those of you who do not know what Bellevue is... Some of you are old enough to remember the Honeymooners, where Ralph Cramden would always talk about Bellevue, Pound to the Moon Alice. Anyway, I was sent to Bellevue, and I'm getting my first patient ever. For those of you who do not know New York City, Bellevue is in the 30s on the east side of Manhattan. In the 30s, towards the west side of Manhattan, there is this place called Madison Square Garden. Now, I know you don't like them, but there is a team called the New York Knickerbockers, also known as the New York Knicks, to play in Madison Square Garden. It's an arena... And the New York Knicks are a basketball team. Well, one night, which happened to be the night that I was at Bellevue awaiting my first patient, there was a young man at Madison Square Garden at the Knicks game, a basketball game, and this kid was wearing a baseball hat. Now, it's not so unusual to wear a baseball hat to a basketball game, except he was wearing nothing else. He was only wearing a baseball hat walking around Madison Square Garden. And the cops picked him up and brought him to Bellevue. And he came in, like, right away, he was a guy, because I'm, like, really sharp like that, and I got him a hospital gown, and then I start sitting down, and I start taking notes. And I'm the next Sigmund Freud, man. I'm, like, really hot. I'm doing this analysis and transference and counter-transference of this and that. I'm scribbling out these notes, and I finally finished about 15 pages of notes, and the attending psychiatrist comes in, and he looks at me, and this lesson has remained for me, with me for many, many years. He looks at me, and he's nodding up and down. I'm thinking, right? And he says to me, how old is this kid? I said, kid's 16. And he takes my notes, and he goes, rip, rip. And he drops it in the waste paper basket. I go, what are you doing? Then the psychiatrist says to me, kid's 16. 16-year-olds do that kind of stuff. Teenagers are very strange beings. They are wild, and they are woolly, and they are uncontrollable. And we're going to get back to that in a second because they do some bizarre stuff. Orbit, satellization. Orbit begins to widen and widen and widen and widen until it hardly resembles an orbit at all. And that being who used to have at the center of its universe mommy and daddy is looking to make something else the center of its universe, and it finds that something else. It desatellizes from mom and dad. We're going to desatellization, peer group, friends. During the teenage years, whoa, do they exert influence on the individual? They are at the center of the universe of this individual are the teens, the peers around them. They exert incredible influence. Like what? How a teenager walks and talks and acts. How they go through life, what makes them happy, what makes them sad, what their morals and values and ethics and ideals and attitudes and goals and dreams are all powerfully being shaped by this peer group. Peer group. Middle of the universe. As a teen drifts through this middle stage, all of a sudden the orbit begins to widen again, wider and wider and wider and wider, hardly resembles an orbit at all, and there's another being out there, and these two beings find each other, and their universes start revolving around each other. They resatellize. They've gone from satellization to desatellization to resatellization. Two human beings who are at the center of each other's universe start the process all over again with their own kids, and that's what happens normally. Except nothing happens normally. That's the problem. All kinds of things can go wrong. And what happens during these middle years where they're away from you and they have the peer group around them, which of course means that you really need to know who your kids' friends are. Where are they going? Whom are they hanging out with? What is it that's going on in their lives? You are not being meddlesome by taking an active interest in what your kids are doing. And without going through the real, how was school? Fine. Homework? No. How's the quiz? Good. Boom. End of dialogue. The amount of minutes, not hours, the amount of minutes on average that the American parent spends with their teenager is pathetic. It's terrible. The number of hours per week, which is at 56 for the average American teenager that they are either on the computer, IMing and video gaming, or on television 56 hours a week. It's 1.25 times longer than an average work week. What the average teenager is on television, the number of minutes per day that a parent is spending with a kid. We gotta flip that around somehow, because that is leading to a whole lot of problems. We got other problems as well. Some call consensual validation. What's that? As for those of you following, we're up to number two. Consensual validation. What's consensual validation? It means that the individual behaves differently in a group than he will as an individual. For example, they found out lynch mobs in the Deep South, who went out and hung a guy in a tree, there was not a single individual in that group that was capable of killing another human being. But as a group, they were able to go out and do that. A human being might never conceive ever of stuffing another human being into a gas chamber. But if the group is doing it, well, they can go out and do it too, and even get rewarded for it. Let me try and give you some more basic. That's too highfalutin for teenagers. Okay, teenager might never do this if they were by themselves. Teenager might never do this if they were by themselves or with their parents, but when they're with their friends, it's really easy to go into the pizza parlor and unscrew the top of the salt shakers so the next guy that comes in with his french fries and all the salt. That's so funny. Right? You might never do this by yourself, but when you go to watch a basketball game, and as a teenager, the only thing you can afford are the cheap seats in the nosebleed section, so you take your peanuts up there, and you eat the peanuts, and throw the shells on the railing, and they peanut rain, and everybody down there below in the expensive section. That's funny. They do bizarre things, but we do bizarre things too, because the power of the group is so intense that it causes us to behave in ways that we would never behave if we were alone. The next time you are at a simcha, this is homework. Homework, he gives homework. How dare he comes from New York and gives homework? No, listen. Next time you're at a simcha, right in the middle when the band is all cranked up, step out for a second and use what I call the Krug lens finder technique. You're going to step back and you're going to cup your hands like this, and you take one guy and follow him, because you will see psychotic behavior. Because you would never do this if you're by yourself. But when 80 other people are going, it's insane! We're insane! We're standing here running up and down like idiots! Why? Power of the group. Power of the group moves us to do things that we could and would never do ourselves. By the way, positively harnessed, a community, a congregation being led by a rabbi who knows what he's doing, power in that community to do things that the individual could never accomplish. You can harness it positively. It can be an incredibly destructive force. Keep your eye on it. Keep your eye on it with your kids, because you'll see that functioning, and there's this force, there's this energy force there. Problem is, it's a little hard to get to that energy for us today. Why? I talked about language before. We're doing something very strange. We're going backwards in time. It's called regressing. Let me give you an example from satellization. We talk about satellization and re-satellization, desatellization. How do you move from point A to point B, and from point B to point C? How do you navigate this middle road? And by the way, I am talking to myself here. When I say that there's been a failure in the Jewish educational world, there's been a failure in the religious leadership of the world, that we are not teaching our kids how to build and how to construct a self. The most important construction job you will ever do is not the addition on the house. It's I'm building myself, two words, the self that is me. What materials do I need? What tools are there? What skills do I need for those tools? How full is that toolbox? Am I going to build a self on poured concrete with steel girders running through it so it will stand up invariably to the storms of life that come along, to the challenges, to the adversities that are going to impact everybody in their lives at some point? Or does it look like really good from the outside, but there's nothing there? There's no essence of being there. And the first wind that comes along, it blows over. We don't teach kids either how to build a self or to put the time that is necessary into building a self. I'm going to come back to the notion of time a little bit later on. regression means to move backwards in time. Let me give you an example from stabilization and then give you an example I'm talking about with language. And all this is going to be tied up to the kids, okay? I'm moving from point A to point B to point C, from stabilization to desatellization to resatellization. What can happen? Well, I can slam into a brick wall, okay? My mind can continue growing, my body can continue growing, and my emotions slam into a brick wall and I'm stuck back there, okay? I'm not talking necessarily about the 45-year-old man living with a 75-year-old mother who asks mommy if it's okay if he goes out on a date Saturday night. That's a guy that's stuck back in stabilization. By the way, you can be propelled back to stabilization as well. Traumas can take the human being and fling them back and forth in life. So for example, you have a chayal, you have a soldier fighting in Lebanon, and all of a sudden he's shot, and he's bleeding and dying into the sands of Lebanon, and as he dies, he cries out for his mother. Not his wife, his mother. Because this trauma has picked him up and flung him backwards in time, and he's all the way back in civilization. I see my patients sometimes. They curl up into fetal positions. They start crying. There's nothing wrong with crying. Crying is fine. But it's regressive behavior. Babies cry. We can move back and forth. And how do we propel our kids to keep going forward? One of the ways that they're shooting themselves in the foot is something that is brand new. We have a new verb in the English language called I-emming. For those of you who aren't familiar with the, how many of you know what I-emming is? Hey, how many of you just raise your hands and have teenagers? Okay, high correlation there. Okay, I-emming is instant messaging. Okay, and here's what we have cooking right now. Kid has language acquisition. Remember, little kid who said, yeah, right? Okay, one day the kid comes and he goes, sees this four-legged creature standing over there, and he goes, doggy. And the father goes, hey, my son's talking, man. He said doggy. And he's like all excited, right? That's really good. Okay. And doggy becomes dog. And dog becomes big dog. And big dog becomes big bad dog. And eventually the youngster is able to tell you about a mangy mongrel with bared fangs and rabbit froth dripping off its pearly lips. Descriptive terminology indeed. Now, when that little kid went, doggy, he may have meant a mangy mongrel with bared fangs and rabbit froth dripping off its pearly lips, but was unable to articulate that because did not have the language or descriptive terminology that goes along with being able to actually describe what they were seeing or thinking or feeling, okay? Some of us in the room, like me, born right after the Civil War, some of us in the room remember the days when there was a thing called a telegram. A telegram is long gone. There was a problem with a telegram. You went to a telegraph office, and you paid money, and they went beep, 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 and they sent a message out to any place in the world. Problem with a telegram was as follows. You paid by the word. Those of you who remember this. Every single word you had to pay for. So you would never send a telegram like, dear grandma, next Thursday we're having a birthday party in the backyard for little Jamie who's going to be 4 years old. We would be most honored if you would come and be the first person to cut the cake for us. Please join us at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, looking forward to seeing you. You wouldn't send a telegram like that, much too expensive. So what do? You send a telegram, party, Thursday, 4 o'clock, come. Okay? And that was your telegram. Well, that's called telegraphic speech. Little kids talk in telegraphic speech, like when they go, doggy, okay? Well, we have a little problem here, because not only do teenagers talk in telegraphic speech today, but adults are beginning to talk like that also. Why? Good question. I'm glad you asked. It shows you're interested. Keep the enthusiasm rolling. We talk like that because of IMing, because of emails, because of faxes. If you look at an IMing or IMing going on, you will see bizarre things. Gone are things like punctuation, capitalization, adverbs, adjectives, descriptive terminology. They're all out the window. We're using symbols instead of words, so that the number four has replaced the word F-O-R. And abbreviations for everything, G-T-G, gotta go, L-O-L, laugh out loud. And of course, the real bad ones, P-I-R, parent in room. If you ever have a little kid there and he gets a P-I-R coming across that, that's the only thing worse than P-I-R is P-O-S, which is parent over shoulder. That's like really bad news. But this is what's going on in the world of I-Ming today. And lo and behold, and I found this only in the last few years, this is very recent, kids have started to talk to each other like that as well. Gone is dialogue. Gone is exchange of ideas. People are talking in short, terse sentences without descriptive terminology. And we are regressing, moving backwards in time with our language, hence linguistic regression, which is on here, I believe, is thing number three. It's a real problem. It's a real issue. And adults have started to talk like that as well. And by the way, we're all under these pressures. When I talk about the number of minutes the parents spend with the kids, we're all under this pressure of time. And of course, all our kids who go to like really nice Jewish day schools can all give the right answers. They're programmed to give the right answers, which is a problem in education. We're not teaching kids to think. We're programming them, just like you program computers. So you ask a kid, hey, what's the first Rashi in Chumash? They'll be able to tell you like that. Oh, the first Rashi in Chumash is, the first Rashi in Chumash is really interesting because he starts by quoting his father. He says, Amar Rav Yitzchak. He talks about his dad, which is very interesting. First Rashi in Chumash, the Torah should not have started with the Bereishis Bara Elokim. The Torah should not have started with, in the beginning, the Torah should have started with, Hachodesh Hazeh Yelachem Rosh Chodeshim. The Torah should have started with, this should be for you the first month. What is that? Well, it shows up in Shemot. It shows up in Parshas Bo. It shows up in the book Exodus. And it says that you should proclaim Rosh Chodesh. Hey, what a great mitzvah. Whee! That's really exciting to start the Torah with. Well, yeah, it's the first commandment that was given to the Jewish people as a nation. I happen to love the guy that I'm about to tell you about. Some of you may be familiar with him. The Sforno. The Sforno was a commentator on Chumash. Powerful. Powerful, and he keeps hammering the point that I'm going to get to now, which we have taken in the 21st century and destroyed. Over and over again, he comes up with this. If you look, you have to read. You have to read Mefarshim. You have to read Tanakh dramatically. We're not taught to read Tanakh dramatically. If you look there, where it says Achodus Hayzeh Yelachem Rosh Chodeshim, if you look in Parshas Bo, you look at the Sforno. He says, comes thundering at us. He says, Mikan Va'elach. What's God doing from now on? I, God, am giving you this new nation, the Jewish people, this incredibly precious gift of time to do with what you want. This notion of time. Bizarre notion. Why is it a bizarre notion? Because we all have the same amount. It doesn't matter if you're white or black or rich or poor or you live in Chicago or live in New York. We all got 60 seconds a minute and 60 minutes an hour, 24 hours a day and 7 days a week and 52 weeks a year. And the question is, how do we use this time? What goes on during, this moment of a quarter to 11 on Thursday morning, November the 23rd, will never come back. Yeah, I can do tomorrow what I should have done today, but what am I doing with this moment? The Sforno hammers that over and over again. When the Jews get man, when the Jews get man in the wilderness, and everybody has a question on the following. He says, L'man ana seno hayelech mesor esilo. Please pardon me, I'm also a rabbi. One of the occupational hazards of being a rabbi is to get a Dvar Torah. And also, it says, L'man ana seno hayelech mesor esilo. I've given you man to test you. Hey, man? Oh, what test? God, give me free food. What test is there? Everybody asks that question. They'll come up with different answers. Rashi said, I'm going to see if you're going to keep the laws of Shabbos now that you have the law. Sforno, now that I've given you your parnasa and you don't have to worry about food, what are you going to do with your time? Time, that incredibly weird commodity in our society that's also responsible for this linguistic regression that I'm talking about. I do the following, which I'm railing against right now. I do this too. Two things. I'll give you an example. As I am faxing somebody in line one, I call on line two to say I'm sending you a fax, sending an answer. In the olden days, you wrote a letter, and you drafted it, and you revised the draft, and you put it in the mail, and 3 days later they got it, and when they got it, they opened it up, they thought about it, they wrote a letter, they sent you an answer back. And a week, 10 days, after you sent your original letter, you get an answer back. I have the faxes coming through. I want the answer. We have time to think. And bam, we responded. I've been getting a very interesting question in the last 10 years, 12 years. And I've been doing informal Jewish education for the last 30 years. In the last 10 years, I've been getting a strange question. Who, what? Rabbi, why is benching so long? I think to myself, good question. You're a chassam nozer. Grace after meals. Why is it so long? I think to myself, it's been the same length for hundreds and hundreds of years. Why am I only getting this question now? And I do this too! I'm about to make a politically incorrect statement, okay? It'd be politically correct nowadays. Even a mailman is called a person today because of the political correctness. In the olden days, the wife was in the kitchen and she was cooking and she spent a long time cooking. And the husband came home, and the kids came home, they sat down for dinner, and you all have dinner together, and they sat for 45 minutes, and if you sit for 45 minutes for dinner, and you've cooked for several hours, and you bench for 3 minutes, benching is short. I do this as well. I come flying into the house, go to the refrigerator, my wife has left me a plate, I stick it into this little box called a microwave, open the door, slam in the plate, slam it shut, push 3-0, cook. 30 seconds, oh god, beep! Rip open the door, wolf down the food in 2 minutes, and then I bench for 3 minutes? Benching is long. And that's why I'm getting this question. We've taken time and we've crushed it. That is a real problem. We, the Jewish people, long before anybody in the United States came up with time is money, the Jewish people said that this thing called time has an element of holiness to it, has an element of Kedushah. We invoke a blessing. We say God's name, Baruch Atah Hashem Mekadesh Hazmanim. We bless He who has sanctified time for us. Of course, it's not the bracha. The bracha is Baruch Atah Hashem Mekadesh Yisrael Hazmanim. That when God and the Jewish people are working in harmony together, that's when time gets sanctified. So we've taken time, we've crushed it, and we've disposed of it, which leads to another problem. I'm going to tie all this together for you tonight. It's a little neat bundle, I hope, very soon, okay? What happens? We live in a disposable society where everything has come crumpled up and thrown away, crumpled up and thrown away, crumpled up and thrown away. I can get a new one. So we have disposable diapers and plastic tablecloths and plastic forks and paper cups and paper plates, and everything is crumpled up and thrown away. Even products have planned obsolescence built into them. I worked my way through my smicha as a mechanic and tow truck driver of a police dispatch tow truck. I have a very checkered history. And why do I mention that? Because you have something in your engines called a timing chain that in the olden days was a chain. And it went around these metal gears inside your engine. In order to get to that timing chain, you have to take the whole front of the engine off. They no longer have a timing chain, but you don't know that. They have a timing belt. It's made of rubber. And it doesn't go around metal cogs anymore. It goes around plastic cogs. And these plastic teeth tend to break off after about 4 years. Why? Because the average American buys a new car every 4 years, or they lease a car and get a new car every 2 years. So why do we, the auto companies, have to build a car to last for 10 years? So there's plan up, it's all crumpled up and throw it away. Now that has leaked into our lives, it's leaked into our kids' lives. So that things like loyalty and dedication and commitment and friendship and love and marriages have all become crumpled up and thrown away. I can get a new one. Because we don't invest that time. We're not investing the time to build a self. We're not investing the time in the relationships. We're not investing the time with our kids. We're not teaching our kids how to do this. And I'm talking to me. I'm really talking to me at this point. It's a major challenge. I'm going to throw out two more ideas and then try and tie things up and take questions. I know we're having a panel later on, but I'd like to take some questions here if I can. There's something called the double bind, which is one of the things on your list. What's the double bind? We love to use this as parents. That's when we play both sides against the middle. So, for example, your kid, you go to your kid, you go, you know something? You're 16 years old. How come you can't blah, 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 blah? Okay? And a kid comes to you for something, you go, you know something? You're only 16. I really don't think you can. And a kid's going, wait a second. You're giving me a very mixed message here. You talk to me about, well, when you want to do it positively, use that for yourself. When you do it negatively, or this one. It's a famous one. By the way, I was going to write a book. Lines that your parents used on you that you swore you would never use on your kids that you will use on your kids. And if he told you to jump off the Empire State Building, or perhaps in Chicago, the Sears Tower, you know, there's one of these things, right? Or a famous one, not while you're under my roof, you know. It's a fun one for parents, but mostly fathers, by the way. By the way, I'm only saying this because I am one, I have experienced this, but men are dorks in terms of understanding relationships. We really are. You know, when my kids used to cry, I would go, a kid's crying, and my wife would go, she needs her diaper change. Where did she need her diaper change? Kids crying. It's a different cry when a baby needs his diaper change, but I can't pick that up. I'm talking about picking up things. You ever see a man pick up a baby? It's like really cool. Like women pick up babies and they hold babies. Yeah, honey, here's a kid, right? We're not like really cool with that kind of stuff. I'm going to maybe talk about this a little bit later on. Talking about language, men and women use very different language. Men talk to their kids very, very differently. than women do in general. And of course, there are always role reversals and stuff like that. Men tend to use something, well, I might mention this later on also, men tend to use something called report language, and women talk in rapport language. Women are talking about feelings, and I listen to conversations that go on between men. They're talking about the stock, they're talking about the ball game, and we're talking about raising children and some of the problems associated with, you know, living in the challenges of today's world. It's amazing. Okay, let me set the stage for you with this one. Okay, reports, short, terse, to the point, get rid of it. Okay, and women's rapport language. Husband's sitting there and he has a newspaper, and reading the newspaper, the wife comes on, she goes, I hate my job. Why don't you quit? Back to the newspaper. Problem solved! That's it, all done. Ready to move on to the next thing, right? And the guy thinks he's being very nice because he's not putting any pressure on his wife, right? Like, you know, and what she wants to hear is, oh, you must have had a really rough day. Sit down, clean up. Let me make you a cup of coffee. Listen, men, forget it. It ain't happening. Okay, so let me go into this double bind and how we work the double bind. One of my favorite ones I get from the kids all the time, where a parent says to a kid, how come you can't be like Mikey next door? Mikey is wonderful. Mikey does his homework. Mikey's on top of things. Mikey's extracurricular activity. Mikey's playing the best school. How come you can't be like Mikey? And then like a couple weeks later, the kid comes and says, there was a party Saturday night. I love to go to the party, and even Mikey's going, I don't care what anybody else does, right? Wait a second. You know, once again, you're playing both sides against the middle. That's not fair to me, says this kid. It's called the double bind. But we do that in other powerful ways as well. Because it's not what we say, it's what we do. Sometimes it requires a little introspection. You know, in the Haggadah it says, the whole dover dor chayav adam lirosis atzmo ki ilhu yotzami Mitzrayim. First time to see himself as if he came out of Egypt. I like to repunctuate that. I like to say, the whole dover dor chayav adam lirosis atzmo. First time to introspect. We have to look at ourselves and what we're doing. And sometimes we give off, unintentionally, sometimes more intentionally, mixed messages to our kids. For example, do not steal. It is wrong to steal. It is illegal. It is immoral. It is unethical. The boogeyman will come get you. Do not steal. Next night, Dad comes in, he has all these pads and papers and markers and stuff under his arm. The kid goes, hey, Dad, where'd you get stuff? He'll turn from the office. Bing, the light lights up. Hey, wait a second. He's telling me one thing, but he's doing another. I'm sorry, I'm picking on dads. I'm just more familiar how we mess up. Or, hey, kids, who wants to go to the movies?
Yeah, we got some movies.
Okay, guys, let's everybody pile in the minivan. We're going to go to the movies now. Okay, when we get there, I want you to say you're 12 years old. I know you're 6'3" and 240 pounds. But when you are 12 years old, you only pay $3.50 to get into the movies instead of $9.50. Don't worry, I'll handle this. Two adults and one, two, three children, please, okay? So you can say all that you want to say about being truthful, about being honest, and about somebody calls. Tell them I'm not home! Oh. There are other ways if you don't want to talk to somebody to get that across. But these subtle things are being picked up by these kids who have these incredible antennas that they're wearing. And they're picking up these messages that are emanating from us. And what kind of messages do we give? How do we handle anger? How do we relate to our spouses? How do we encourage a loving relationship in the family? How do we use the time around that precious thing called the Shabbos table, that Mizbeach that sits in our dining room every Friday night? This is all part and parcel of what it means to grow up in a world where the forces are pulling so powerfully in the opposite direction of that which is our value system and our moral system. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the latest blight in teenagedom, which is called Facebook. Latest thing in cyberspace, or myspace.com. And the kinds of things that you find on Facebook would make a sailor blush. But our kids are out there cruising around this new world where there are no rules and no regulations and no form of protocol whatsoever. And they're cruising through the world of cyberspace. And a parent came to me horrified at what they found about their kid on Facebook and the kind of pictures that have been posted. I spoke to the kid. And the kid was furious that their parent had been on Facebook. Because the kid said to me, it's my diary. I said, it's not your diary. I said, your diary you wrote in, and you kept in the back of the drawer, your chest of drawers under some clothing, so nobody would find it, nobody would read it. It was your passion, it was your secret. You put something like that out there, it's international. Anybody can download it. And unfortunately, the only thing that's frightening the kids that I speak to is that colleges are now checking Facebook before they look through applications. And that frightens them? How come they're not frightened by what is out there? How come they're not moved by what it is they're doing in this world called cyberspace and doing it in a linguistically regressive form to begin with? These are forces that are mitigating against what we believe in and what we want to have for our children. Let me tell you a quick story. I mentioned I work in professional theater. So one of the types of clientele that I treat are professional actors. I see some very famous actors. I cannot tell you who they are because of confidentiality. I do not want to lose my license. But I see a couple of very famous actors. One of the actors that I see, I know that you all know. He's a star of stage and screen and television. He has houses all over. He has a house in California and New York and Europe, etc. What you do not know about this particular actor is that he is almost bald. There's nothing wrong with bald. He is almost bald, but he has 8 wigs. Why does he have 8 wigs? These wigs are very expensive. They cost between $4,000 and $5,000 a piece. Why does he have 8 wigs? Because each wig is progressively longer than the preceding wig. So each week he puts on one of his longer wigs because his hair is growing. And on the 8th week, he goes back to his shortest wig because he just had a haircut. Oh, very nice. Okay. So let me tell you what happened with this guy. This guy comes into my office one day, and he's holding this cup of coffee, which he had picked up at the 7-Eleven on the way into my office. And he comes into my office, and he takes his cup of coffee, and he throws it against the wall of my office. I got coffee all over the place. And like right away, I knew the guy was upset because I'm like really sharp like that. Coffee all over the place. And I said, what was going on? What was going on is as follows. And this is part of where I'm trying to head. He had been in his apartment in New York. He was doing a Broadway show at the time. And he was in his apartment and he wanted to go downstairs and buy a New York Post. It's a newspaper that cost 25 cents. And he was in his apartment. And as he's putting his wig on and his clothes, because his public is used to seeing him in a certain kind of clothing, as he was getting dressed to go down and buy the newspaper and he's looking in the mirror, he realized with horror that there was no him. There was no essence to his being. He didn't exist. His whole life was an act. And he wasn't getting into costume to do a Broadway show. He wasn't getting into character to do a movie. And that's what we pay the professional actor for, because when you're shooting a movie, you're shooting a scene for a couple of minutes, and they have to set up the next scene and test the audio and make sure the camera directions are right, and the guy's sitting on the side in his chair, and he comes in and shoots the next scene. What we pay the actor for is his ability to sustain a character throughout a film, because he has to keep getting into the same character every time they do a shoot. You can get into character. A good actor can get into character to do a Broadway show for 2.5 or 3 hours. You cannot sustain getting into character to do life. And as he looked at himself in the mirror, he realized there was no essence to his being. There was no him. And it made him very angry. Well, maybe it made him angry, because what I'm about to say is very important for any of you who might have teenage sons. When you see anger, particularly in males, and more particularly in teenage males, and you see anger, you scratch the surface just a little bit, what you find is depression. Because depression and anger are fueled by the same energy resource. So sometimes your kid, your teenage kid, is acting angry, and your desire is to respond in anger. Hold off for a second and say to yourself, hey, what's going on here? It's always wise to do that instead of being reactive, to be proactive, to try and understand the motivations for your kid. For example, I came home one day. This was a Friday. I came home, I had given psych tests to my class. I had all these psych tests in my arm, my attaché case. And I walk into the back door of my house. I don't know how many of you have ever seen The Pink Panther with Inspector Clouseau, and especially the original one with Peter Sellers. Well, I was Inspector Clouseau. I came into the back door of my house on this Friday, and all I remember is going, ah, yeah! And sailing across the kitchen, ending up on the other side of the kitchen, on my rear end. There were papers all over the place. My attaché case had gone flying. I had no idea what was going on, and I turned around, and there was my 4-year-old polishing the floor with a tub of margarine. She had scooped out this entire tub of margarine and was on the floor. And I hit that thing, man. It was like an oil slick. That was wonderful. And my first impulse was to strangle her. You know, I think my pride was probably more hurt than my guns. But there I was sitting on the other side, and I actually, one of the few times, I can be a big shot, I'm going to tell you about the successes, because I've messed up plenty, one of the few times where it was successful, I said to myself, what is she doing? And I realized what she was doing. She was trying to help clean for Shabbos. She had seen me, right, the night before scrubbing the floor, yeah, scrub the floors in the house, she had seen me scrubbing the floors in the house, and she wanted to help. Now, would I have done absolutely irreparable, irreversible, permanent damage psychologically to this kid if I would have yelled and gone berserk on her, which I have done on occasion, by the way. I'll give you another example in a second of one of my failures. I don't know if I would have done irreparable damage, but in her mind, this is part of the double bind. In her mind, she was doing something nice. And I would have yelled at her, would have left her very confused. And I actually thanked her. And then I went into, but you have to ask mommy and daddy first, and you have to, and we don't do it. I couldn't get the stuff off, by the way. You just can't wipe up this stuff. It's unbelievable. And it led to us cleaning together for Shabbos, which is a little kid. And she would have this little spritz bottle of water, and I had the Windex, and we'd be doing these full-length mirrors, and she'd be cleaning the bottom, and I'd clean the top. And until she entered her teens, where she rebelled, we actually used to clean together for Shabbos. Listen, we all lose it. The same kid of mine, when she was about 12, which means my youngest was about 5, we were at the Shabbos table. I don't know if you have this stuff here, but Pfeiffer makes this Italian dressing that is full of oil and little pieces of red pepper and onion and stuff like that. And you shake it, it looks like a little snowstorm inside, right? And my daughter is sitting at the table shaking this stuff. Debbie, put it down, please. And she puts it down. 2 minutes later, she picks it up and starts shaking it. Put it down. Something's going to happen. Puts it down. Third time, she picks up. Debbie, leave it alone. Well, the fourth time when she picked it up and started shaking it, it flew out of her hand and smashed into a crystal pitcher that had been full of apple juice, and the glass bottle of Pfeiffer Italian dressing broke, and the apple juice pitcher broke, and I had broken glass and apple juice and Italian dressing all over my Shabbos table. I went berserk. I went nuts, okay? I was dancing like a madman. All my kids went, right? Patrolling, 500, like me, this dash. We all lose it. There's no question about it. Question is, looking at the motivation. Yeah, she was cleaning that floor. What was her motivation for doing that? She was trying to help. So when you see anger in your teenage kid, scratch the surface and think, it might be anger, it might be. But stop for a second and think, I wonder if there's something going on. I wonder if he's oppressed about something. Also, when your kid comes home, this is another example, and flings her knapsack on the floor and bumps up the step, it's not the greatest time to go chase. What happened? Something happened today? Well, you can tell me. Please tell me what happened. It's not the time to do that. You know, if your husband came home and did that, you give him some space. Your kid needs that space also. I find at the time at night, when the kid's defense is a little bit down, a little bit tired, it's a good time to talk to kids. But if they come in and fling their knapsack down and stomp up the steps, let them go unless they want to talk, unless they approach you and they say they want to talk to you. But this goes back to this little dialogue game. I got into so much trouble in my school years ago because I set my psych class up to do an experiment with your parents. I say, how many of you get home and you go through this ritual every day? Hi, how are you? Good. How was school? Fine. Homework? No. And the end of the thing. I said, where's that trial experiment? When you get home tonight, I want you to say to your parents, I got to talk to you, please, about something. And write down what your parents say. They all went home, and they said, and they come up, hi, how are you? Good. Mom, I had to talk to you about something. I don't have time right now. Ooh, you don't have time right now, so what'd you ask me how I am for, right? I was getting a response like that. Then the parents found out that they had been the butt of this experiment that I was running my psych class. I got killed for it. It was wonderful. What I'd like to try to do is wrap up some of these things. I think I actually covered a lot of what was on the outline here. Linguistic regression, consensual validation. You're all experts right now on all kinds of psychobabble stuff that you didn't know before. Satellization theory, that word called time. I'm going to leave you with one story before I go to questions. I was about to audition somebody for a Broadway play. I was part of the auditioning team. When you audition, there was something called open call. Open call means you put an advertisement in the trade paper, it's Variety, show business, backstage, and anybody can come and audition. That was my job when I was at the Fantastics. They used to audition people and decide to get to which roles. When somebody comes into audition, I'll give you an example. One of my auditions at the Fantastics, which was off-Broadway, the job paid about $270 a week take-home, had 187 people show up. 15 got callbacks, 3 got second callbacks, 1 guy got the job. And what happens when you see somebody on stage and they're doing something intriguing, you want to give them something to play to see if they can take direction. So when I was auditioning, I'm setting this up as a prelude to the story that I'm about to tell you. Somebody came in one day and he did his lines, and he was something very interesting about this guy, except he did his lines too slowly. So I could have said to him, okay, do it again, except do it faster. I didn't do that. I gave him something to play. I said, I'm calling you up. I want you to do it again. I'm calling you on stage. I want you to pretend you have to go to the bathroom really badly. Now, I could tell if this guy was a professional or an amateur, because amateurs do stuff like indicate, do all kinds of, like, not nice things. This guy was good. He came in. He went on stage. He did his lines. He did them quickly. It was obviously one of the finished lines and left. Okay? That told me he could take direction. That's what you do during audition. If you see something intriguing, you work the ball with the actor, see where they can go. Well, here I'm in this Broadway house. It's a really nerve-wracking experience. Because you go in, and you have about 2 minutes to pour your guts out all over the stage, and whoever's out there, the producer, the director, the stage manager, assistant stage manager, the choreographer, the set designer, the line designer, sitting there, and you have to convince them that you are the one for the job. And we're auditioning for a musical. You also come in and you sing. Usually a prepared piece. Sometimes you pay to bring your own accompanist in. There's all kinds of interesting, nerve-wracking things. In walks this guy onto the stage, and he is big, black, and beautiful. He was about 6'3", and he had this kind of voice that just starts at the bottom of your feet and just wells out through your entire body. He was magnificent. And he gets up there. It's a true story. I'm going to make up a story. The two stories are too wonderful. He gets up there, he sings this piece that he prepared. And we're sitting going, wow, wow. And the director says, usually it's off. Thanks, don't call us, we'll call you next. Right? The director didn't do this. The director started giving him stuff to play. The director says to him, hey, that was very good. You know the song, Show Me the Way to Go Home? Like a really stupid song, right? Show me the way to go home, right? He goes, you know that? The guy goes, yeah, go sing it for me. So he sings Show Me the Way to Go Home. And then the director started piling on stuff. He says, I want you to sing Show Me the Way to Go Home like a cowboy. Like that, the guy became a cowboy with the bow legs and the western drawl and his lasso and his walking around the stage singing Show Me the Way to Go Home. Okay, I want you to sing Show Me the Way to Go Home like a cowboy in a dude ranch. It was not a real cowboy, but a guy trying to pass himself off as a cowboy. And he did it. And it was different than his real cowboy, Show Me the Way to Go Home. Okay, I want you to sing Show Me the Way to Go Home like a Nazi stormtrooper. Like that, the guy became a Nazi stormtrooper. It was really weird to see this black guy with a German accent boot-stepping across the stage singing Show Me the Way to Go Home. Okay, I want you to sing Show Me the Way to Go Home like a Hawaiian diver diving for pearls. He starts swimming, Show Me the Way to Go Home. While the guy was auditioning for us, the apartment house that he lived in Greenwich Village in New York had caught fire. And his roommate had been in the apartment, the fire department had come and had evacuated the building, and his roommate had run out of the building and called the theater to tell his guy to get home because everything he owned was going up in smoke. And sitting next to the assistant stage manager with a phone with a blinking light, they don't have, you know, bells in theaters, and the guy was on stage auditioning when this call comes in, his roommate who had been evacuated from this burning building. And the guy was in the middle of doing his Nazi stormtrooper Show Me the Way to Go Home. And the phone blings, and the assistant stage manager picks up, he listens for a second, goes, oh my God, your house is on fire! Like that, the guy became a fireman. And he starts singing Show Me the Way to Go Home like a fireman. And the assistant stage manager goes, no, your house is burning. He thought he wasn't doing it well enough, so he took his hose, he hooked up to the fire and bloody did his stuff in the morning, took his axe and started chopping down the door, singing Show Me the Way to Go Home like a fireman. And finally, the assistant stage manager goes over, he whispers in the ear of the director. The director stands up, he goes, stop, cock, hold it, whoop, Chapman, one second. He goes, you have a roommate named John? He goes, yeah. He goes, you live down on 4th Avenue in the East Village? He goes, yeah. He goes, you're the apartment building there? He goes, yeah. He goes, you don't anymore, your place burnt down, right? The guy goes, ah! Right, rushed out of the building. He got the part, by the way. Point of story. Okay, this goes to the heart. This goes to the heart of what we're talking about today. This is what we pay the professional actor for. To know everything there is to know about a cowboy. Or a cowboy in a dude ranch. Or a Hawaiian diver diving for pearls. Or a Nazi stormtrooper. Or a Russian astronaut. Or a shyster lawyer versus a Park Avenue lawyer. Or a chauffeur driver versus a taxi driver. Everything about them. How they walk and talk and act and react. All those things I mentioned before. What their morals and values and ethics and ideals and attitudes and goals and dreams are. That's what we pay the professional actor for. And they know it. And the good actors know that. They've been studying that. And they study it very well. Do we know that about ourselves? Do we know that about our spouses? What makes them happy and sad and walk and talk and act and react? Do we know that about our kids? That's the challenge of being a parent in today's world. Zooming with technology that has outstripped the human being's psychological ability to keep up with it as life zooms past us. By the way, anybody know the original code, area code for Chicago? Anybody remember?
312.
The 312. Anybody know why it was 312? Very interesting story, talking about speed. Because in the olden days, you stuck your finger into a hole and you had to go, and the phone went, and all it came all the way around. Okay? The middle digit of area codes had to be a 1 or a 0. And in order to dial quickly, all the big important cities were given low area codes, so it didn't take so much time for the dial to go around. So New York was 212. And Chicago was 312. Because Chicago was a pretty important city. And you didn't have an area code like 907, which took so long for that dial to go around. I mean, nowadays, the push buttons, you don't have that anymore. So we've been aware of this, but it has eroded our ability. And by the way, I'm saying this publicly, in Jewish education, we have set up a system that is impossible, absolutely impossible. When kids in our system will go to school from 7:30 to 5:15 every day, to get the best yeshivot in Israel, get to the best university they can, play a couple of sports, be involved in extracurricular activities, do some chesed, get all their homework done, and get 8 hours sleep a night. It's not possible. We've set up a system that's not possible for them. And in that crunching time, as we've wound up our kids like little robots to go down the road of life, somehow we've bypassed the human element of their development. I'm talking to me, and my 5 biological kids. I'm talking to me and my 650 students in my school. I'm talking to me and the graduate students that I teach at Yeshiva University. It's a challenge. And if we don't meet the challenge, because I believe what I'm saying, Dvarim Hayotzim Min HaLev, you and your kids are our future. And I don't mean to be cliched and clicky about that. We're a very small people. There are very few of us lying around. And unless we spend the time and the effort and understanding some of these concepts that I can go on for hours, just touching the tip of a little iceberg here, that's the challenge of going to be our success. And yeah, during the teenage years, you might have to wait years for that feedback. You might have to wait years to hear I love you. I'm coming from the heart. Sometimes you want to hear it before it's ready to be said. But you got to keep plugging in anyway. Mickey has his hand number 5. I think I'm getting the high sign that I need to stop. If anybody has any questions, we're going to have a panel later on, and you have a chance to ask questions. Anybody have any questions they want to hit just on this one topic here? I'm pleased to open up the floor at this point. I thank you very, very much. As I said, I hope you all took good notes. It'll be a short quiz next period. Anybody have any questions that you'd like to ask? Keep the enthusiasm rolling. Listen, I'm going to do an experiment. Ms. Akkad, I'm doing an experiment here. It's very hard to be the first one to ask a question. I'm going to skip the first question and go straight to the second one. Anybody? Thank God, yes.
Well, I mean, what you've said is beyond 100% accurate. Sure. As I've shared with you before, yeah. I work at a high school with teenagers. How do we direct parents? How do we direct ourselves to fight what we're facing today? With Facebook and MySpace and everything else, how do we even begin to make a dent?
Well, you're doing it. The fact that your shul offered such an event today, the fact that you guys showed up means there's an interest for it. So that's already a step in the right direction. Enhancing communication, getting the religious leaders to take a more active role, preparing our teachers better, looking at the realities of what we face versus the fantasies of what we want to think we want to create. It all plugs into the system. Again, this is something that we could work for weeks on and again, not begin to scratch the surface. It's an excellent question. Those are 3 answers. I'm about to get yanked from here.
Okay.
Rabbi, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Rabbi Dr.